Hello, and welcome to our third SpudSmart webinar of 2017. Today, we'll be looking at the importance of soil health. My name is Janet Canters, and I am the editor of SpudSmart magazine and SpudSmart.com, and today I will be your moderator. Before we begin, I'd like to thank our sponsors of the webinar, McCain Foods and BASF, for their support. I'd also like to note a few housekeeping items. The webinar is being recorded, and it will be made available on spudsmart.com following the event. Probably by next Monday, it will be available. For audio quality purposes, all microphones have been muted with the exception of the speakers. But we do welcome your input, so if you have a question or comment, please share it in the chat box at the bottom left side of your screen and let us know to whom it is directed. So today we have two speakers who will talk about soil health in potatoes. Wayne Honeycutt, the President and CEO with the Soil Health Institute, and Bob Larkin, a research plant pathologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Agricultural Research Service. Today we're going to start with Wayne, who will talk about the importance of healthy soils in potato production, followed by Bob, who will talk about incorporating soil health management practices into potato cropping systems. So we're ready to go with our first speaker, Wayne Honeycutt. Go ahead, Wayne.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning, depending on which time zone you're in. And thank you, Janet, and thanks to all the good folks at SpudSmart that gave us the opportunity to visit with you today. I'd like to spend a little bit of time with you just talking somewhat about what the scientific basis is of soil health. I'm sure many of you have been hearing a lot about soil health these days, and I wanted to hit up some of the items that where we feel like that kind of the scientific merit is really very strong for focusing on soil health. First, a quick definition. We look at soil health as the capacity of the soil to function as a vital living ecosystem that sustains plants, animals, and humans. So a couple of key words here I want to focus in on. One of them is that word function. When we talk about soil functions, and we're talking about things like providing nutrients and providing water to the plants. Other key words are vital living ecosystem. We've come a really long way looking at nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, other things, other inputs like that the soil needs to grow our crops. But this is kind of a refocus on that biological, that living component of the soil from which we derive so many benefits. Now, one of the key measures of soil health is organic carbon. It's really the best way that you measure the organic matter in the soil by actually determining its carbon content. And there's a lot of different measures, but organic carbon is one of the most critical ones. And this is why it's so important. When you look at the relationship between organic carbon and water, you can see in that shaded area, when you increase the organic carbon in the soil, what that does, the available water holding capacity in that soil, you can see how that shaded area there just fans out. So you can really significantly increase the available water holding capacity of your soil by increasing the carbon in the soil, that organic matter, what imparts that dark color to the soil. By our estimates, when you increase the organic carbon just by 1%, you increase the ability of that soils to hold water anywhere from 2,500 to some 12,000 gallons per acre. And that's only in the top 6 inches. So you can imagine what that does now to the resilience of your soil and your crops and your animals that are feeding on those crops to things like drought. Here's another one of the reasons why it's really important to look at increasing your organic carbon in the soil. Look what happens now, when you increase carbon, how you reduce the density of the soil. This is over 1,000 data points that were combined in this one study by Alan Franzlubers to show you this relationship. And when you think of what that means to a plant root in terms of its ability now to move through that soil that is now less dense, because of that higher carbon in the soil. So now that root can move more easily through that soil and pick up moisture and nutrients. Now, one of the key practices for enhancing soil health, for increasing that carbon, is no-till. Now, I recognize you all are growing potatoes, and so we'll come back to that. But I wanted to point this out, is that what we're really kind of talking about in most no-till situations is that this plant material on the surface starts to decompose. And those roots, those stems, those stalks, those leaves there on the surface, they now actually become decomposed and actually part of that soil organic carbon, that soil organic matter. There's a number of studies that have shown that using no-till, you can increase that organic carbon, that organic matter in your soil. Here's four different studies in Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky, where compared to conventional tillage, they significantly increased the organic carbon using no-tillage. So the question to you, obviously, as a potato farmer, is how you can really kind of benefit from some of these practices, because we recognize that potatoes is very disruptive to the soil. A no-till potato system, even though I understand there's a few people experimenting with it, and some growers, I believe, are a few at least, are doing it quite successfully, it's obviously not a mainstream practice. So I'm not here to try to preach to you or anything saying that you need to convert potatoes to no-till. So please don't think I'm going to be doing that. But what I would encourage you to do is to think of yourselves not just as potato producers, but as carbon managers, and think, how can you, for example, in the rotation year or in the non-growing season, like with cover crops, how can you become a more effective carbon manager and really look at your carbon inputs and try to minimize the disruption to the soil in order to allow that buildup of carbon so you can drive those benefits, like increased water holding capacity, like easier root proliferation through your soils. And here is an example of a project that both Bob Larkin, your next speaker, and I worked on together in Maine, where we looked at lengthening the rotation. We added carbon by adding compost to manure. We looked at no-tilling the barley and the timothy in the rotation segments of the year. We had cover crops. And so there were a lot of things we were doing, and by lengthening the rotation and increasing the diversity and using more practices that were more conservation-minded in the non-potato year to actually really kind of build up that organic carbon in the soil, really improve that soil. Another key practice that you can employ, and when you're not growing potatoes, is in the fall and in those rotation years, is cover crops. And of course, this is where you are just growing those crops at a time when your main crop is not growing, and you can burn them down, or there are some crops like winter rye where you can roll and crimp them at a particular growth stage that the crop will die naturally, and then you have a mulch to plant into. So that mulch can help, you know, control weeds. It can help control moisture and add more moisture to the soil. Here's one of the benefits, and it's a little schematic here of growing cover crops. Looking at on the your far left there, summer one, just soybeans, looking at the rooting depth. But then if you had this particular case, a cereal rye cover crop that had a significantly deeper rooting depth, now you have more root channels for that next year's, that next summer's crop. And so that it's easier for that next year's roots to penetrate deeper, take up more moisture, take up more nutrients. Some of the examples that I'm showing you have been taken directly from the literature. And this particular study was a survey that was done back in the historic drought of 2012. Where a number of different farmers, several hundred of them, were interviewed, and they reported this, that they had about 11 to 14% yield increase on their corn and in their soybeans, respectively, when they followed cover crops. And so these benefits really often show up the strongest in those drought years or those stress years. Now, another thing about things like cover crops that you could benefit from is that they will lead to greater infiltration of water in the soil. So you don't have as much running off. You have more water that now infiltrating the soil so that it can be there when the plants need it. Here's four different studies in the scientific literature and I won't spend a lot of time on them, but just the first one in Kansas where they had a no-till winter wheat and sorghum as their crop, and that when they added cover crops, they got a 182% increase in the rate or the speed that water infiltrated into that soil when they added that cover crop to it. The next study down, they got 164% to 462% increase when they added cover crops, different sites in different years. The next study 132 to 194, the next one down 165. So you got really significant increases in the rate that the water infiltrates into that soil. And so when you get a much greater infiltration rate, now you're not losing as many nutrients, and now, you know, through runoff, and now you are essentially replenishing that subsoil with moisture. And these types of observations are not just academic. When you're out there at the right time, the right place, you can see them in the real world. And here is one example in South Dakota where they have no-till soybeans on the left side of the fence, and on the right, it's conventionally tilled soybeans. You can see on the left, there's no standing water, but on the right that there is. So what's happening is a number of things. One is on the left, you have the residue that is protecting the surface. And when that happens, the individual sand, silt, and clay particles, they bind together into what we call aggregates. When you get better aggregation in your soil, then you have more pore space, and so more water can get in and infiltrate in. But then on the other side of the fence, where they conventionally till, one of the things that happens is that that soil, those aggregates, are no longer protected. So when the raindrops hit them, then they break down. Those aggregates break down into their individual sand, silt, and clay particles, and then they settle out. And so you can really kind of eventually form kind of a crust, and so you don't get as much water infiltrating in. And so the farmer or the field on the right, they're really kind of missing that opportunity to recharge that soil with moisture. Now, there are also a number of water quality benefits, and we know that increasingly farmers and farms are kind of in the spotlight for looking at nutrient additions, runoff to our waterways. But there's a number of benefits to a lot of these other practices like cover crops, too, in terms of water quality. Here again, in the research literature, a lot of different studies, different locations, different kinds of cover crops. But this third column over from the left, look at the percent reduction in the amount of nitrate, nitrogen that was leached in that study. 65 to 70%, 30%, 63, 61, 61. You can read the numbers on down through there. So significant reductions in the amount of nitrate that was lost to groundwater. So that's, yeah, there's that whole environmental effect. But also, by reducing those nutrient losses, you're keeping those nutrients available for your crop, you know, that you purchased, essentially. So it can be help with your economics of your situation, too, in your practices. Another key soil health practice that you can obviously use is rotation. Thinking, again, as yourself as a carbon manager, what rotations can you employ that would return a lot of carbon to your soil? And can you lengthen your rotation in order to build up your soil organic matter and build up this resilience? One of rotations that I suspect Bob is going to be visiting with you on here in a few minutes is things like canola that can not only build up your carbon, but that also can add disease suppression and other types of attributes too. Other, of course, rotations and cover crops or legumes are like this one here that can essentially provide a nitrogen, that's nitrogen fixation, taking nitrogen right out of the atmosphere and building it in your soil plant system, enriching your soil that way. And then, of course, biosolids is another opportunity for you in potatoes, is particularly adding and injecting, I should say, animal manures, other biosolids that can really help build up your organic matter, therefore your resilience, your nutrient storage and availability, and other good qualities. So one of the things I wanted to leave you with here was the fact that at the Soil Health Institute, we have taken these and a number of other ideas, and we've looked and identified what a lot of the research gaps are, what a lot of the specific steps are for addressing those research gaps and those adoption gaps. And we've identified what needs to be done to address each of those. And that's one of the things that we do at the Soil Health Institute. We provide that strategy for addressing those types of gaps. And then, quite frankly, we go out and seek funding to address them. And so that's one of the things that I do now as the CEO of the Soil Health Institute, is then I go out and seek funding for it. And since we are funded from a foundation, that funding just goes right back out the door to researchers and to others to implement these practices. So I would just invite each of you to go onto our website at the Soil Health Institute. It's just all one word, and sign up there to receive our quarterly newsletters and our occasional emails that we send out to people in making sure they are aware of certain meetings or some new technology or other events, news releases, or what we have going on. And so I'd encourage each of you to go there, and there's other opportunities also. We have a number of volunteer groups that work with us. We have some 24 different action teams that are related to that action plan that have come together and are working together to advance particular steps and priorities and goals in that action plan. So there's also those opportunities to kind of get engaged at that level if you would like. So I will turn it back over to you all, Janet, and thank you all very much for your attention. I look forward to your questions later on.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Wayne. Here's Bob. Thank you, Wayne. Soil is very important, obviously, to every farmer and agronomist out there. It is the building block of crops. So now we're going to pass on to Bob. Thank you, Bob, and take it away.
All right. Thanks, Janet. And thanks for this opportunity to talk to you folks today. Wayne's given a good background information on soil health and some of the practices involved. What I wanted to talk about was more about how we can try to incorporate some of these practices into existing potato cropping systems and give some more data specifically related to the work we've done with potato cropping systems and their effects on soil properties, crop production, and soil-borne diseases. So, again, Wayne has already introduced the concept of soil health. There's just a couple of things I wanted to bring out about that, and are things that he has mentioned also. But one of the things that's critical, I think, is that when you're talking about soil health, it puts emphasis on the importance of all the multiple functions of soil, not just for crop production or for a specific thing, but all the multiple things that soil does for biomass production, nutrient cycling, filtering and buffering, water storage, biological habitat, all the different things that soil does. That's all involved in soil health. Another aspect that's important to remember is that it encompasses all aspects of the physical, chemical, and biological attributes of soil. And also that building and maintaining the soil health is essential to agriculture sustainability and ecosystem function. So, again, as Wayne went over some of these soil health management strategies and emphasized the importance of managing your organic matter or the carbon in the soil. The rest of this list is some of the priorities that are given, for instance, by the USDA NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, in their promotion and a capacity to instill more people in being aware of soil health. These are some of the primary things that they talk about: minimizing soil disturbances, diversifying the soil biology with plant diversity, maintaining living plants and roots on the soil, keeping that soil covered, and when possible, integrating livestock. All of these things are things that help do the kind of things that Wayne was talking about, those specific practices. And another aspect that I just want to mention briefly before we go on is the importance of soil microbiology. This is something that in the past has been somewhat neglected or ignored, and it is something that is very important to keep in mind, that an active, diverse soil microbiology is necessary for pretty much all the things that we expect soil to do. The soil microbiology, the soil microorganisms, are pretty much the workhorse that accomplish most of these things that we want soil to do regarding the decomposition of organic material, nutrient cycling, soil structure, breakdown of toxins, and even suppression of pathogens and diseases. These are all things that are done by the soil microbiology to the most part. And so in that sense, managing soil health is also largely a matter of maintaining a suitable habitat for these organisms that make up the soil biology. And as Wayne emphasized the importance of organic matter, that's the primary food source for these microorganisms. And so having that available really is important for those microorganisms. But also, a diverse soil microbiology is promoted by a diversity of plants and plant types, which release different sets of organic compounds and interacting with different assemblages of microorganisms. And also, the active diverse soil microbiology does help keep pathogen populations in check and interferes with those pathogens' ability to cause disease. Wayne did a good job, again, of going over some of these soil health management practices that are associated with soil health and why they're important and what they do, things like crop rotation, the cover crops, and green manures is part of that too, where the crop is grown and incorporated while still green, the use of organic amendments to get those higher organic matter levels through things like compost manure or in crop residues and mulches, and also conservation tillage. In reducing that tillage, whether minimum or no-till, all of those things that are involved. And those are all, Wayne made a very good presentation of why those things are important and some of the things that they can do. What I wanted to focus more on is how we can utilize those in potato cropping systems. So several years ago, we began studies looking at how we could incorporate these practices in a potato crop production and what effects they would have. How much improvement could you get by using these various practices? So we set up a cropping system study that would focus on different management goals. Management goals of soil conservation, soil improvement, and disease suppression. So we designed three of the cropping systems that would primarily address those types of things. Where if you're just interested more in maintaining the system you have, it would be an emphasis on soil conservation. If you were trying to build up that soil, it'd be the soil improvement. Or if disease suppression is the primary concern, you would do that. So we designed these systems. We used a comparison with what we consider the standard rotation here where I am in the Northeast U.S., where a two-year rotation of a small grain and then potato is kind of an industry standard that they've been doing for many years. So our status quo rotation, our two-year rotation, was barley underseeded with red clover and then potato the following year. And this was considered a standard. It had both spring tillage and fall tillage and a lot of the normal practices that conventional agriculture has. We compared that with our soil conserving system, which, again, lengthened the rotation to 3 years. And now we still had a small grain, but now we underseeded barley with the forage grass timothy and let that continue for a whole second season, whole second year, as our two-year of non-potato. And we drastically limited tillage. In fact, for those barley forage grass 2 years, it was all done completely no-till. So we removed tillage completely from it from that stage. So we drastically reduced tillage. We also reduced tillage within the potato year as much as we could. And we also followed up our potato crop with a straw mulch added to the surface, again, to keep that ground covered and to reduce erosion, to, again, increase this soil conservation practices. For our soil improvement system, we started with that same soil conserving rotation, barley underseeded with timothy, but now we added large organic matter amendments. We added composted dairy manure at a rate of 20 tons per acre or 45 megagrams per hectare each year to really build up that organic matter to see what kind of impacts that would have. For our disease suppressive system, we started with mustard green manure, and mustard and other brassica crops are known to have disease suppressive properties. And so we had a mustard green manure followed by a rapeseed fall cover crop, and the second year having a Sudan grass green manure, which is another type of crop that also is known to have disease suppressive capabilities. So we had a Sudan grass green manure followed by a winter rye cover crop. So we not only infused the rotation with known disease suppressive crops, but also we increased the crop diversity by having and cover by having a rotation crop and a cover every year, and then followed with our potato. And just as a kind of a negative control there, we also had a non-rotation option of a continuous potato. And these systems were conducted under both irrigated and non-irrigated conditions. And we ran the study for almost 10 years, starting in 2004. And so this is a picture of what the field looks like. Got potato there and mustard and canola and some of the various rotations. If we look at this, after we let these rotations go for a while, this is results on soil physical properties after two full rotations or a total of 6 years. We could start to see some of the effects of these kind of cropping systems and the effects of these soil health management practices within these cropping systems. So this looks at soil physical properties. We have soil moisture here as an indicator of water availability, water-stable aggregates as an indicator of soil structure, and bulk density also as an indicator of kind of soil properties. First off, particularly for soil moisture and water-stable aggregates, all of the rotations were significantly improved over no rotation, which is not surprising. But and the three-year rotations with limited tillage, the soil improving and soil conserving systems in the top two rows there, significantly improved over the other rotations for both of those attributes. And overall, for like the disease suppressive, also improved water-stable aggregates over the standard two-year rotation. With bulk density, basically you needed those three-year rotations with that addition of the no tillage or the reduced tillage to really see an improvement in bulk density over that amount of time. That's something that's kind of slower to change, but the soil improving system had a more substantial effect than any other system. As also was obvious in the soil moisture. The soil improvement system increased soil moisture holding there by 35% over the standard rotation and increased water stable aggregates by 10% over the standard rotation. That just gives an idea of some of the effects that these kind of things can have in a short period of time in the rotation cycle. Looking at next, some of the effects on some of the more chemical or biological properties. This just shows a few of them: total carbon, total nitrogen, organic matter, cation sink capacity, and microbial biomass carbon. And you see here the top line soil improvement system in highlighted in yellow. significantly improves all these characteristics better than any other rotation, and for some of them by substantial margin. For instance, the organic matter, its increase over the standard rotation, the SQ system, by almost 70%, and almost 90% increase over the non-rotation control. So we had a dramatic effect on increasing organic matter. And also, just about all of the other nutritional elements that we are concerned with also were increased dramatically. This just shows total carbon and total nitrogen, but also potassium, phosphorus, calcium, magnesium. All of those were also significantly increased in the soil improving system over any of the other systems. And you'll see at the bottom that for most of the characteristics, the non-rotation control was significantly lower than any of the others. That just means that any rotation is better than no rotation, but rotations that include some of these properties can also enhance it over some rotations that don't. But some of those characteristics take a while to develop, so you don't see as much difference among some of the other rotations as you might over time. But it just shows some of those effects. Wayne went over why you see some of those effects and what's happening with infiltration and with a lot of these things, but this kind of demonstrates in potato systems that we do see those same kind of effects that he was talking about. In the last column, particularly is microbial biomass carbon, shows the dramatic increase in microbial activity and biomass. Yeah, 40% increase over the status quo and over 100% increase, or approximately 100% increase over the non-rotation. Okay, so moving on to effects on yield. This shows total tuber yield over average over a five-year period. And if you look at that first row of bars that is not under non-irrigated conditions, and you see here that the bar on the left, the blue bar, the soil improving system, significant improvement in yield over all other systems, 40% increase over the non-rotation, and about a 30% increase over the FT status quo. And this kind of demonstrates that effects of having that water, increased water holding capacity of the soil improving system, that we achieved high yield even when they weren't irrigated. When we did irrigate, you see that all the systems except the soil improving substantially increased yield, average increase of about 25% increase in yield for the other cropping systems. But there was relatively little effect in the soil improving system. So because of that increased water holding capacity, that basically comparable yields were obtained whether it was irrigated or not irrigated. But under irrigated conditions, overall, our disease suppressor system achieved the highest yield with in improving yield by about 20% over the non-rotation. If you look at the comparison of the irrigated disease suppressive versus the non-irrigated non-rotation control, there's over a 53% increase in yield just by adding those attributes, and a 40% increase over the non-irrigated status quo system. So with the combination of irrigation and these better improved cropping systems, we substantially improved yield. I also just wanted to briefly mention the same kind of things we observed with effects on soil-borne diseases. This shows effects on severity of black scurf, which is caused by Dectonia solani. And you see again in the front row with the non-irrigated conditions, all the rotations improved disease relative to the non-rotation, but that the disease suppressive system reduced disease much better than any of the other rotations. So our goal of getting producing a disease suppressive rotation system worked there. We did get lower disease than any other system there, with more than a 20% decrease over other systems, and even more over non-rotation. But also note though that the soil in this instance, the soil improvement system did not reduce disease any more than our status quo system in this case. So even though it did increase that organic matter, it doesn't always relate to a better control of disease, but it can in some cases. If you look back at the second row there under irrigated conditions, see that under irrigated conditions, disease increased somewhat in most of the rotations, although the disease suppressive system still maintained low disease level under both irrigated and non-irrigated conditions. So this study did a lot to show just how effective some of these practices can be when used in a potato cropping system. However, and it also indicated that soil health, disease suppression, and soil moisture are key components for all of these things, particularly for crop production. But one thing that this particular study was not necessarily designed to produce the most practical rotations for growers, in that they were designed to see what would be the biggest impact we could get using these types of practices. So for a follow-up to that study, we then modify these rotations to try to develop rotations that would use those same type of principles, but be more practical and be more feasible and useful on an actual grower condition, to design rotations that would work in a practical setting. So that's what we did in our modified study, which has been running since 2013. So we kept the same designations of the systems, and we kept the same status quo system, our soil conserving system. Now we modified that to a barley underseeded with ryegrass, because we'd seen that ryegrass would work better as a underseeded crop for reducing disease and improving soil health characteristics. The second year then we had canola as a cash crop, followed by winter rye cover. Canola also has some disease suppressive capability. With our soil improving system, we had the same system with compost amendments, but with compost amendments seriously stepped back. We are anticipating adding the compost maybe once every 3 or 4 years instead of every year. But in this study, we maintained the previous system, so we actually didn't add any additional compost. We just kept the same system without adding additional. In our disease suppressive system, we also started with barley underseeded with ryegrass, but in the second year, then we had our mustard green manure as a disease suppressive rotation with our rapeseed cover. And then also compared again with continuous potato. So this system has been running since 2013. We waited for a full rotation cycle before we collected data, which was 20. And so in 2015 and 16, we collected the data, and we're also going to be looking at, we're also running that again this year for more data on that system. Well, what we saw was confirmed similar things that we saw in the previous study, in that the soil improving system still was able to maintain higher yields than any of the other studies. And now this is under non-irrigated conditions. And so again, we had about a 30% increase in yield over our status quo system with the soil improving system, but also about a 20% increase with our disease suppressive system. So even though they were modified, we still had similar type results. So the systems were still working in the same way. This shows microbial respiration as another indicator of soil microbial activity. And again, it shows the high levels of activity for soil improving system, a little bit lower but still higher levels for the disease suppressive system, and then the lower levels for the status quo system, and much lower for the non-rotation system. Again, just as an indication of those kind of rotation effects on those properties. And this shows where we are now with organic matter content. The soil improvement system is maintaining organic matter at about 5.2%. Our disease suppressive system is slowly building organic matter at about 4.1%. The soil conserving and soil status quo systems are maintaining organic matter levels similar to where they were at the start, and in the non-rotation system, we're actually losing organic matter over with each season over time, so that's declining. Lastly, then here we've got some, just as an indication again of soil soil-borne diseases. We've got black scurf severity levels, and again, the disease suppressive system is still maintaining lower levels of disease than the other cropping system. And this is also the case for common scab as well. The last slide I wanted to mention about this study too is again an indication of microbial community composition. This is indicated by here by fatty acid profiles, which is a measure of microbial community composition, just to show how the different cropping systems has differential effects on these microbial communities. At the upper left corner, you'll see that's the non-rotation control, far removed from all the other systems because it's very different. And the far right, soil improving system has drastically changed our soil microbial communities. And at the bottom of the graph, then, you have the disease suppressive and soil conserving system, which also has affected the cropping systems quite dramatically, but in a very different way than the soil improvement system. So this just shows that each system has some characteristics that it imparts on the soil microbial communities that differentiate some of these factors. So in conclusion, then, I just wanted to emphasize that incorporating some of these manual practices into the heading cropping systems can improve soil physical, chemical, and biological properties, resulting in improved nutrition, enhanced yield, and disease suppression, and that use of disease suppressive rotation crops can reduce soil-borne diseases and improve yield and disease suppression. Disease suppressive green manures and cover crops and compost amendments can be incorporated into practical and economically viable potato cropping systems to improve soil health and improve potato production. And just as a concluding comment, based on our research, again, which was conducted in Maine, our overall best management of the soil-borne diseases, soil health, and sustainable production includes using a three-year or longer rotation with conservation tillage where applicable, implementing a disease-suppressive rotation crop prior to your potato crop, and that could be some brassica crop like the mustard, Sudan grass, or if you can't fit those in your rotation, the ryegrass or small grain can also have some disease-suppressive capability. Also, we want to include cover crops. Winter rye or ryegrass work well following your rotation crop. And you can use compost amendments to increase that organic matter and some of these other properties. And after potato year of the rotation could include some alternative cash crop or small grain. And that is what I wanted to cover. There's a lot of people that were involved in these studies over the years. And I just wanted to display that. I also, on this slide, also has a couple of recent publications that kind of go over some of these same kind of things that I talked about, as well as my email address for anybody who wants to contact me about this sort of thing. So with that, I guess we can open it up to questions and comments. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob. That was a great job by both our speakers, a lot of information to take in. So if you have any questions, please type them into the chat box now. I see some are coming in, so We'll go to them here in a moment. I have a couple of questions quickly, and it's just more of an overall answer we're looking for at this point. So I'll start with Wayne. Wayne, in potato production particularly, since we're talking potatoes today, why is maintaining health, soil health so important in potatoes specifically?
Well, obviously, one of them that Bob hit on was the importance of disease suppression. But I tell you, you know, you look at potato tuber itself, it's approximately 80% water. And potatoes and potato growth, the growth of potato plant itself, is so dependent upon available moisture that, in my opinion, enhancing the available water holding capacity through these soil health practices is one of the most important things that you can do for potato production. It's obviously true for any crop, but I think potatoes in particular are very sensitive to moisture deficits. Their yield really responds negatively in a very sharp manner when not having enough water. And so to improve the water holding capacity so that the soil and the plant makes the most of what water it has is just really critical for improving a potato yield.
You bet. I would also add to that that potato production is particularly hard on soils compared to some other production systems because of the large amounts of tillage and the times of where a lot of times we've got tilled soil that are left uncovered. It's particularly hard on soil for erosion and loss of topsoil and cover and loss of nutrients, so that building that those soil health characters back up in potato production, I think, is even more critical than some other types of crops where you do have, like a grain crop, where you have more extensive root systems and it's in place for a longer period of time and you don't have all of that tillage. So, potato production is just particularly damaging to soils. So it needs that extra help to try to build that soil back up.
Great. What are your thoughts, Bob, on adding buckwheat as a cover crop to the rotation?
Buckwheat is good. We've only done limited research with it, but buckwheat works well as a green manure or just as a cover crop. It produces a nice root system, and it works well as a plow down green manure crop. I don't have a lot of specific data on it, but we have looked at it, and we have included it in some trials, and I don't have much information on it for disease reduction, but I've heard that some people say that it can also help reduce disease. So what I've heard about it is good, but I don't have much of my own research on it.
Okay, that's something perhaps SpudSmart can cover here down the road. What type of compost was used in your studies, Bob?
This is a dairy manure compost from local dairy operations. So it's composted dairy manure. It's about 50% solids. I've got all of the specifications of it, but I don't have that at my fingertips. But it was prepared at a dairy operation, and we purchased it from them and trucked it over and applied it.
Okay. I have in the story we had in SpudSmart in the summer issue, we talked a little bit about integrating livestock into potato production. So Wayne, I believe there was some crop and livestock integration in Maine where some potato growers chose to partner with dairy farmers. Can you explain how that works and what the benefits are?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of it comes back to adding new organic matter, increasing your organic matter. And so it's a matter of kind of a resting the soil a little bit from potato producing, but it's also then using those lands to which they've been applying dairy manure, particularly I think they were injecting liquid dairy manure in those soils, And so they basically increase the organic matter in the soil. That improves its water holding capacity, improves the nutrient availability. And so they were able to get real significant increases in their potato production. And there was some farmers that were actually going into partnerships, a dairy farmer going into partnerships with potato farmers and buying more land together and swapping land so that they could have that rotation benefit.
It'd be interesting to find out if producers are working with other livestock producers in that thing. That's something I might have to look into as well. Bob, here's a question. Have you evaluated other soil-borne pathogens in these studies, such as nematodes?
Well, we've looked at whatever we had in those fields, so we've tried to evaluate everything we have. We have not had a problem with nematodes in those particular trials. We did have another trial where we had a verticillium wilt problem, and we looked into whether nematodes were the cause in it, but we didn't really have a nematode problem. It was mainly just a verticillium problem. And that was part of some other rotation trials. But as far as other soil-borne diseases, tuber diseases, we every year look at rhizoctonia, both on the roots for crown rot, stolen rot, common scab, silver scurf. Those are the main ones that we routinely see. So we have a lot of data on that. We have looked at, in some other studies, at things like powdery scab, verticillium wilt, and a few others. But, you know, obviously, you kind of have whatever disease problems are present in that particular field. So we don't necessarily have data on everything. But on this particular cropping system study, rhizoctonia and common scab were the primary soil-borne diseases we saw, and we just did not really have large amounts of other diseases.
Okay. Back to the dairy for just a moment, Wayne and Bob, I guess. Have you done any research on that? So, for instance, one of the questions that have come in is, have you examined the microbiome population profile to see if new beneficials are emerging?
That's probably a little bit more in Bob's. I have not personally. Bob, have you?
Well, that's something we're trying to get more into. Like in these fields this year, we are doing a full microbiome analysis using, you know, the current next gen sequencing techniques to identify more completely the microbial communities and the composition of the microorganisms within these different cropping systems. So we will have more information on that. I haven't specifically done in relation to dairy work, but like I said, I mean, it would include those cropping systems where we didn't have the large amendments of dairy manure, and to see over time how they've affected the microbiome. So we are starting to get that. We're extracting the DNA from soil now, and we're sending those off to be sequenced and analyzed, and we should have some information on that by next year.
Okay. Bob, your three-year rotation included a brassica, Sudan grass, and ryegrass, or a small grain. What are some of the other options for growers who don't have access to these rotation crops, or for whatever reason they can't grow those ones in their area?
Yeah, one of the limitations of the brassicas is the seasonality of it. They especially in our situation, and I'm sure in most of Canada, you know, they don't really work as a fall cover crop, which, you know, some places in the Northwest, they use them as a fall cover crop. That doesn't work here in the Northeast, and it probably doesn't work up in the latitude you are in Canada. So there is some limitations with the use of those brassicas. And just, yeah, some people are a little bit leery of incorporating those. Some of the other, what's barley and oats and that sort of things are the small grains that are usually used. We're trying to look at other alternative rotation crops for some of these things, but it depends on in your area what are the crops that will work, and it's very very regional, I guess, as far as what crops make sense for your location. And like okay. Western Canada, I guess there's a lot more wheat, I guess, grown there, right?
We're talking about all location. Of Canada.
It
depends what area you're in, I guess, and that just involves a little bit more research with their local agronomists, I guess, can help them with that,
right.
I would think. Mm-hmm. I have a question here from someone, and it doesn't really necessarily talk about soil, except it does. So here it is. They want to leave their oat and wheat straw on the fields after the grain's harvested, but they think it might not be a good idea because scab will overwinter in the straw. What are your thoughts on that?
This is on wheat. So you're talking about wheat straw left in the field.
Yeah.
There is a concern among a lot of growers that if they increase their organic matter, that they're going to have more problems with scab. And that hasn't really been borne out in the research. It hasn't really shown that it's because of higher organic matters. And that may be similar with the straw. Scab can, survive for fairly long periods, but usually when people have seen increases in scabs, there may be other reasons for it than just that because they've had more organic matter, whether it's in straw or that. But there is concern about that, but the research that I've seen don't necessarily show that. And that's all I've said about that.
How about alternative brassica oil seeds? Can they help in rotations such as camelina? Would there be a worry about white mold?
Well, white mold can be a problem with brassica rotations with potato. In our rotation studies, we haven't had a problem with white mold, so it didn't come up, but we have done some trials on other fields where if they already had a white mold problem, it is possible that the brassicas could make that a little bit worse. But like I said, so that is a caution if you are known to have had a history of problems with white mold, that brassicas may not be the best option for you, because it is true that could get worse. I don't know specifically about camelina. We've looked at a number of different brassicas for their potential for disease control, but I don't have a lot of. We only had one study where we saw any effect on white mold, and that's just because we haven't had a lot of fields where that was a problem.
Okay. Wayne, I have time for one more question, and it's for you. So are there any what are the economic downsides versus the economic benefits of maintaining soil health? So for instance, if a guy, if a potato grower starts purchasing a no-till planter or cover crop seed, that's going to cost him. So is maintaining soil health an economic benefit, more of an economic benefit than a downside at the end of the day?
Yes, I think there's mounting evidence that demonstrates that the economics are in favor of these soil health promoting practices, but I'll also be the first to admit that there needs to be more work done on that. We are actually supporting some of that work now through the Soil Health Institute with a grant that we received from the Walton Family Foundation, because there's different aspects of economics. There's the profitability aspect that you immediately think of, but there's also the aspect of reducing economic risk, because these soil health promoting practices, they can essentially increase yield stability over time, and so therefore reduce economic risk also. And so there is that aspect of economics to also consider. But when I visit with farmers about adopting these practices, I often encourage them that if you're trying some of these soil health promoting practices out for, you know, it is a fresh start, that I encourage them to not go all in immediately, but to try it on the back 20 acres or 40 acres and maybe rent a no-till drill the first year or two, you know, in your rotation, or try, you know, cover crops in 40 acres and not on all 4,000 acres, for example, and so that they can learn the management aspects of it as they go.
Great. That's great advice. You know, you don't have to go all in for the whole thing every year sort of thing. Okay, that's all we have time for today. I want to thank both our speakers for making time in their busy schedule to share their insights and expertise. I hope everyone has found the information valuable. I also want to point out that today, the last couple of days, the Soil Conservation Council of Canada has they're undergoing their annual conference in Guelph, and you can follow them along at hashtag SoilSummit17. So they're talking about Canadian soil health, and that might be a good way to finish up your day. So I also want to thank Kyle Dorado. So I want to thank our speakers, Dr. Wayne Honeycutt and Dr. Bob Larkin. I'd like to pass on a very big thank you to our sponsors, McCain Foods and BASF, for their support. And I want to quickly thank Kyle Dradawani and Teresa Kurjewitz, our team working behind the scenes, for their assistance. So this presentation will be made available online at spudsmart.com early next week. Thanks for your attention. And on behalf of the team here at SpudSmart, we hope you have a great rest of your day.